Side 18, It, by Stephen King, continuing on page 665. "How do you like that, nigger dog?" Henry asked it, and it rolled its dying eyes up at the sound of Henry's voice and tried to wag its tail. "Did you like your lunch, you shitty mutt?" When the dog was dead, Henry removed the clothesline, went home, and told his father what he had done. Oscar Bowers was extremely crazy by that time. A year later, his wife would leave him after he beat her nearly to death. Henry was likewise frightened of his father and felt a terrible hate for him sometimes, but he also loved him. And that afternoon, after he had told, he felt he had finally found the key to his father's affections, because his father had clapped him on the back so hard that Henry almost fell over, taken him in the living room, and given him a beer. It was the first beer Henry had ever had, and for all the rest of his years he would associate that taste with positive emotions, victory and love. "Here's to a good job well done," Henry's crazy father had said. They clicked their brown bottles together and drank them down. So far as Henry knew, the niggers had never found out who killed their dog, but he supposed they had their suspicions. He hoped they did. The others in the Losers Club knew Mike by sight. In a town where he was the only Negro child, it would have been strange if they had not. But that was all, because Mike didn't go to Derry Elementary School. His mother was a devout Baptist, and Mike was therefore sent to the Neibolt Street Church School. In between geography, reading, and arithmetic, there were Bible drills, lessons on such subjects as the meaning of the Ten Commandments in a godless world, and discussion groups on how to handle everyday moral problems. If you saw a buddy shoplifting, for instance, or heard a teacher taking the name of God in vain. Mike thought the church school was okay. There were times when he suspected, in a vague way, that he was missing some things. A wider communication with kids his own age, perhaps. But he was willing to wait until high school for these things to happen. The prospect made him a little nervous because his skin was brown, but both his mother and father had been well treated in town as far as Mike could see, and Mike believed he would be treated well if he treated others the same way. The exception to this rule, of course, was Henry Bowers. Although he tried to show it as little as possible, Mike went in constant terror of Henry. In 1958, Mike was slim and well-built, taller than Stan Urus, but not quite as tall as Bill Denbrough. He was fast and agile, and that had saved him from several beatings at Henry's hands. And, of course, he went to a different school. Because of that and the age difference, their paths rarely coincided. Mike took pains to keep things that way. So the irony was this. Although Henry hated Mike Hanlon more than any other kid in Derry, Mike had been the least hurt of any of them. Oh, he had taken his lumps. The spring after he had killed Mike's dog, Henry sprang out of the bushes one day while Mike was walking toward town to go to the library. It was late March, warm enough for bike riding, but in those days Witcham Road turned to dirt just beyond the Bowers place, which meant that it was a quagmire of mud, no good for bikes. "Hello, nigger," Henry had said, emerging from the bushes, grinning. Mike backed off, eyes flicking warily right and left, watching for a chance to get away. He knew that if he could buttonhook around Henry, he could outdistance him. Henry was big and Henry was strong, but Henry was also slow. "Gonna make me a tar baby," Henry said, advancing on the smaller boy. "You're not black enough, but I'll fix that." Mike cut his eyes to the left and twitched his body in that direction. Henry took the bait and broke that way, too fast and too far to pull himself back. Reversing with a sweet and natural speed, Mike took off to the right. In high school, he would make the varsity football team as a tailback his sophomore year, and was only kept from breaking the school's all-time scoring record by a broken leg halfway through his senior season. He would have made it easily past Henry, but for the mud. It was greasy, and Mike slipped to his knees. Before he could get up, Henry was upon him. "Nigger, nigger, nigger," Henry cried in a kind of religious ecstasy as he rolled Mike over. Mud went up the back of Mike's shirt and down the back of his pants. He could feel it squeezing into his shoes. But he did not begin to cry until Henry slathered mud across his face, plugging up both of his nostrils. "Now you're black," Henry had screamed gleefully, rubbing mud in Mike's hair. "Now you're really black." He ripped up Mike's poplin jacket and the t-shirt beneath and slammed a poultice of mud down over the boy's belly button. "Now you're as black as midnight in a mine shaft," Henry screamed triumphantly and slammed mud plugs into both of Mike's ears. Then he stood back, muddy hands hooked into his belt, and yelled, "I killed your dog, black boy!" but Mike did not hear this because of the mud in his ears and his own terrified sobs. Henry kicked a final sticky clot of mud onto Mike and then turned and walked home, not looking back. A few moments later, Mike got up and did the same, still weeping. His mother was, of course, furious. She wanted Will Hanlon to call Chief Borton and have him out to the Bowers' house before the sun went down. "He's been after Mikey before," Mike heard her say. He was sitting in the bathtub and his parents were in the kitchen. This was his second tub of water. The first had turned black almost the moment he had stepped into it and sat down. In her fury, his mother had lapsed into a thick Texas patois Mike could barely understand. "You put the law on him, Will Hanlon, both the dog and the pup. You law him, hear me?" Will heard, but did not do as his wife asked. Eventually, when she cooled down, by then it was that night and Mike 2 hours asleep, he refreshed her on the facts of life. Chief Borton was not Sheriff Sullivan. If Borton had been sheriff when the incident of the poisoned chickens occurred, Will would never have gotten his $200 and would have had to be content with that state of affairs. Some men would stand behind you and some men wouldn't. Borton was of the latter type. He was, in fact, a jellyfish. "Mike has had trouble with that kid before, yes," he told Jessica. "But he hasn't had much because he's careful around Henry Bowers. This will serve to make him more careful."
"You mean you're just going to let it go?"
"Bowers has told his son stories about his dealings with me, I guess," Will said. "And his son hates the three of us because of them, and because his father has also told him that hating niggers is what men are supposed to do. It all comes back to that. I can't change the fact that our son is a Negro any more than I can sit here and tell you that Henry Bowers is going to be the last one to take after him because his skin's brown. He's going to have to deal with it all the rest of his life, as I have dealt with it, and you have dealt with it. Why, right there in that Christian school you were bound he was going to go to, the teacher told them blacks weren't as good as whites because Noah's son Ham looked at his father while he was drunk and naked, and Noah's other two boys cast their eyes aside. That's why the sons of Ham were condemned to always be hewers of wood and drawers of water," she said. And Mikey said she was looking right at him while she told that story to them. Jessica looked at her husband, mute and miserable. Two tears fell, one from each eye, and tracked slowly down her face.
"Isn't there ever any getting away from it?"
His reply was kind but implacable. It was a time when wives believed their husbands, and Jessica had no reason to doubt her will. "No, there is no getting away from the word nigger. Not now, not in the world we've been given to live in, you and me. Country niggers from Maine are still niggers. I have thought, times, that the reason I came back to Derry was that there is no better place to remember that. But I'll have a talk with the boy." The next day he called Mike out of the barn. Will sat on the yoke of his harrow and patted a place next to him for Mike. "You want to stay out of that Henry Bowers' way," he said. Mike nodded. "His father is crazy." Mike nodded again. He had heard as much around town. His few glimpses of Mr. Bowers had reinforced the notion. "I don't mean just a little crazy," Will said, lighting a home-rolled Bugler cigarette and looking at his son. "He's about 3 steps away from the booby hatch. He came back from the war that way."
"I think Henry's crazy, too," Mike said.
His voice was low but firm, and that strengthened Will's heart. Although he was, even after a checkered life whose incidents had included almost being burned alive in a jury-rigged speakeasy called the Black Spot, unable to believe a kid like Henry could be crazy. "Well, he's listened to his father too much, but that is only natural," Will said. Yet on this his son was closer to the truth. Henry Bowers, either because of his constant association with his father or because of something else, some interior thing, was indeed slowly but surely going crazy. "I don't want you to make a career out of running away," his father said, "but because you're a Negro, you're apt to be put upon a good deal. Do you know what I mean?"
"Yes, Daddy," Mike said, thinking of Bob Gautier at school, who had tried to explain to Mike that nigger could not be a bad word because his father used it all the time.
In fact, Bob told Mike earnestly it was a good word. When a fighter on the Friday night fights took a bad beating and managed to stay on his feet, his daddy said, "His head is as hard as a nigger's." And when someone was really putting out at his work, which for Mr. Gautier was star beef in town, his daddy said, "That man works like a nigger." "And my daddy is just as much a Christian as your daddy," Bob had finished. Mike remembered that, looking at Bob Gautier's white, earnest, pinched face, surrounded by the mangy fur of his hand-me-down snowsuit hood.
He had felt not anger, but a terrible sadness that made him feel like crying. He had seen honesty and good intent in Bob's face, but what he had felt was loneliness, distance, a great whistling emptiness between himself and the other boy. "I see that you do know what I mean," Will said, and ruffled his son's hair. "And what it all comes down to is that you have to be careful where you take your stand. You have to ask yourself if Henry Bowers is worth the trouble. Is he?"
"No," Mike said. "No, I don't think so."
It would be yet a while before he changed his mind. July 3, 1958, in fact. 4. While Henry Bowers, Victor Criss, Belch Huggins, Peter Gordon, and a half-retarded high school boy named Steve Sadler, known as Moose, after the character in the Archie comics, were chasing a winded Mike Hanlon through the train yard and toward the Barrens about a half a mile away, Bill and the rest of the Losers Club were still sitting on the bank of the Kanduskeag, pondering their nightmare problem.
"I know where it is, I think," Bill said, finally breaking the silence.
"The sewers," Stan said, and they all jumped at a sudden, harsh, rattling noise. Eddie smiled guiltily as he lowered his aspirator back into his lap. Bill nodded.
"I was asking my father about the sewers of a few heights ago."
"All of this area was originally marsh," Zach told his son, "and the town fathers managed to put what's downtown these days in the very worst part of it. The section of the canal that runs under Center and Main and comes out in Basie Park is really nothing but a drain that happens to hold the Kanduskeag. Most of the year those drains are almost empty, but they're important when the spring runoff comes or when there are floods." He paused here, perhaps thinking that it had been during the flood of the previous autumn that he had lost his younger son. "Because of the pumps," he finished.
"Pumps?"
Bill asked, turning his head a little without even thinking about it. When he stuttered over the plosive sounds, spittle flew from his lips. "The drainage pumps," his father said. "They're in the Barrens. Concrete sleeves that stick about 3 feet out of the ground."
"Ben Hanscom calls them Morlocka holes," Bill said, grinning.
Zach grinned back, but it was a shadow of his old grin. They were in Zach's workshop, where he was turning chair dowels without much interest. "Sump pumps is all they really are, kiddo," he said. "They sit in cylinders about 10 feet deep, and they pump the sewage and the runoff along when the slope of the land levels out or angles up a little. It's old machinery, and the city should have some new pumps, but the council always pleads poverty when the item comes up on the agenda at budget meetings. If I had a quarter for every time I've been down there, up to my knees in crap, rewiring one of those motors... But you don't want to hear all this, Bill. Why don't you go watch TV? I think Sugarfoot's on tonight."
"I want to hear it," Bill said, and not only because he had come to the conclusion that there was something terrible under Derry someplace.
"Why do you want to hear about a bunch of sewer pumps?" Zach asked.
"Skuska Hool report," Bill said wildly.
"School's out."
"No, next year."
"Well, it's a pretty dull subject," Zach said. "Teacher will probably give you an F for putting him to sleep." "Look, here's the Kanduskeag." He drew a straight line in the light fall of sawdust on the table in which his bandsaw was embedded. "And here's the Barrens. Now, because downtown's lower than the residential areas, Kansas Street, say, or the Old Cape or West Broadway, most of the downtown waste has to be pumped into the river. The waste from the houses flows down to the Barrens pretty much on its own. You see?"
Yes, Bill said, drawing a little closer to his father to look at the lines, close enough so that his shoulder was against his father's arm.
"Someday they'll put a stop to pumping raw sewage into the river, and that'll be the end of the whole business. But for now, we've got those pumps in the... What did your buddy call them?"
"Morlock holes,"
Bill said, with not a trace of stutter. Neither he nor his father noticed. "Yeah, that's what the pumps in the Morlock holes are for, anyway, and they work pretty well except when there's too much rain and the streams overflow. Because although the gravity drains and the sewers with the pumps were meant to be separate systems, they actually crisscross all over the place. See?" He drew a series of X's radiating out from the line which represented the Kanduskeag, and Bill nodded. "Well, the only thing you need to know about water draining is that it will go wherever it can. When it gets high, it starts to fill up the drains as well as the sewers. When the water in the drains gets high enough to reach those pumps, it shorts them out. Makes trouble for me, because I have to fix them."
"Dad, how big are the sewers and drains?" You mean what's the bore on them?
Bill nodded.
The main sewers are maybe 6 feet in diameter. The secondaries, from the residential areas, are 3 or 4, I guess. Some of them might be a little bigger. And believe me when I tell you this, Billy, and you can tell your friends, you never want to go into one of those pipes. Not in a game, not on a dare, not for any reason.
Why?
A dozen different town governments have built on them since 1885 or so. During the Depression, the WPA put in a whole secondary drain system and a tertiary sewer system. There was lots of money for public works back then. But the fellow who bossed those projects got killed in World War II, and about 5 years later, the Water Department found out that the system blueprints were mostly gone. That's about 9 pounds of blues that just disappeared sometime between 1937 and 1950. My point is that nobody knows where all the damned sewers and drains go, or why. When they work, nobody cares. When they don't, there's 3 or 4 sad sacks from Dairy Water who have to try and find out which pump went flooey or where the plug-up is. And when they go down there, they damn well pack a lunch. It's dark and it's smelly and there are rats. Those are all good reasons to stay out, but the best reason is that you could get lost. It's happened before. Lost under Dairy. Lost in the sewers. Lost in the dark. There was something so dismal and chilling about the idea that Bill was momentarily silenced. Then he said,
But haven't they ever sent people down to map?
I ought to finish these dowels, Zack said abruptly, turning his back and pulling away. Go on in and see what's on TV.
But, Dad.
Go on, Bill, Zack said, and Bill could feel the coldness again. That coldness made suppers a kind of torture as his father leafed through electrical journals, he hoped for a promotion the following year, as his mother read one of her endless British mysteries. Marsh, Sayers, Innes, Allingham. Eating in that coldness robbed food of its taste. It was like eating frozen dinners that had never seen the inside of an oven. Sometimes, after, he would go up to his room and lie on his bed, holding his griping stomach, and think, He thrusts his fists against the posts and still insists he sees the ghosts. He thought of that more and more since Georgie had died, although his mother had taught him the phrase 2 years before. It had taken on a talismanic cast in his mind. The day he could walk up to his mother and simply speak that phrase without tripping or stuttering, looking her right in the eye as he spoke it, the coldness would break apart. Her eyes would light up and she would hug him and say, Wonderful, Billy. What a good boy. What a good boy. He had, of course, told this to no one. Wild horses would not have dragged it from him. Neither the rack nor the boot would have induced him to give up this secret fantasy, which lay at the very center of his heart. If he could say this phrase, which she had taught him casually one Saturday morning, as he and Georgie sat watching Guy Madison and Andy Devine in The Adventures of Wild Bill Hickok, it would be like the kiss that awakened Sleeping Beauty from her cold dreams to the warmer world of the fairy tale prince's love. He thrusts his fists against the posts and still insists he sees the ghosts. Nor did he tell it to his friends on that July 3rd, but he told them what his father had told him about the dairy sewer and drain systems. He was a boy to whom invention came easily and naturally, sometimes more easily than telling the truth. And the scene he painted was quite different from the scene in which the conversation had actually taken place. He and his old man had been watching the tube together, he said, having cups of coffee.
Your dad lets you have coffee? Eddie asked.
Sure, Bill said.
Wow, Eddie said. My mother would never let me have a coffee. She says the caffeine in it is dangerous.
He paused. She drinks quite a bit of it herself, though.
My dad lets me have coffee if I want it, Beverly said, but he'd kill me if he knew I smoked.
What makes you so sure it's in the sewers? Richie asked, looking from Bill to Stan Uris and then back to Bill again.
Everything goes back to that, Bill said. The voices Beverly heard came from the drain. And the blood. When the clown chased us, those orange buttons were by a sewer. And George...
It wasn't a clown, Big Bill, Richie said. I told you that. I know it's crazy, but it was a werewolf.
He looked at the others defensively.
Honest to God, I saw it.
Bill said,
It was a werewolf for you.
Huh?
Bill said, Don't you see? It was a werewolf for you because you saw that hum movie at the Aladdin.
I don't get it.
I think I do, Ben said quietly. I went to the library and looked it up, Bill said. I think it's a
He paused, throat straining, and spat it out.
A glamour.
Glamour? Eddie asked doubtfully.
Glamour, Bill said, and spelled it.
He told them about an encyclopedia entry on the subject and a chapter he had read in a book called Night's Truth. Glamour, he said, was the Gaelic name for the creature which was haunting Derry. Other races and other cultures at other times had different words for it, but they all meant the same thing. The Plains Indians called it Manitou, which sometimes took the shape of a mountain lion or an elk or an eagle. These same Indians believed that the spirit of a Manitou could sometimes enter them, and at these times it was possible for them to shape the clouds themselves into representations of those animals for which their houses had been named. The Himalayans called it a talus or telus, which meant an evil magic being that could read your mind and then assume the shape of the thing you were most afraid of. In Central Europe, it had been called Ilok, brother of the Verderlok, or vampire. In France, it was le loup-garou, or skin changer, a concept that had been crudely translated as the werewolf. But Bill told them le loup-garou, which he pronounced le loup-garou, could be anything, anything at all, a wolf, a hawk, a sheep, even a bug.
Did any of those articles tell you how to beat a glamour? Beverly asked.
Bill nodded, but he didn't look hopeful.
The Himalayans had a ritual to get rid of it, but it's pretty gruesome.
They looked at him, not wanting to hear, but needing to.
It was called the ritual of chud,
Bill said, and went on to explain what that was. If you were a Himalayan holy man, you tracked the telus. The telus stuck its tongue out. You stuck yours out. You and it overlapped tongues, and then you both bit in all the way, so you were sort of stapled together, eye to eye.
Oh, I think I'm going to puke, Beverly said, rolling over on the dirt.
Ben patted her back tentatively, then looked around to see if he had been observed. He hadn't been. The others were looking at Bill, mesmerized.
What then? Eddie asked.
Well, Bill said, this sounds crazy, but the books said that then you started telling jokes and riddles.
What?
Stan asked. Bill nodded, his face that of a correspondent who wants you to know, without coming right out and saying it, that he doesn't make the news but only reports it.
Right. The first the Telus monster would tell one, then you got to tell one, and you went on like that, taking turns.
Beverly sat up again, knees against her chest, hands linked around her shins.
I don't see how people could talk with their tongues, you know, nailed together.
Richie immediately ran out his tongue, gripped it with his fingers, and intoned,
"My father works in a shit yard."
That broke them all up for a while, even though it was a baby joke.
Well, maybe it was supposed to be telepathy, Bill said. Anyway, if the human laughed first in spite of the pain, Stan asked.
Bill nodded.
Then the Telus got to kill him and eat him. His soul, I think. But if the man could make the Telus laugh first, it had to go away for a 100 years.
Did the book say where a thing like that would come from? Ben asked.
Bill shook his head.
Do you believe any of it?
Stan asked, sounding as if he wanted to scoff but could not quite find the moral or mental force to do so.
Bill shrugged and said, I almost do.
He seemed about to say more, then shook his head and remained silent.
It explains a lot, Eddie said slowly. The clown, the leper, the werewolf.
He looked over at Stan.
The dead boys, too, I guess.
This sounds like a job for Richard Tozier, Richie said, in the movie tone newsreel announcer's voice. Man of 1,000 jokes and 6,000 riddles.
If we sent you to do it, we'd all get killed, Ben said.
Slowly, in great pain. At this, they all laughed again.
So what do we do about it?
Stan demanded, and once again Bill could only shake his head and feel he almost knew.
Stan stood up. Let's go somewhere else, he said. I'm getting fanny fatigue.
I like it here, Beverly said. It's shady and nice.
She glanced at Stan. I suppose you want to do something babyish, like going down to the dump and breaking bottles with rocks.
I like breaking bottles with rocks, Richie said, standing up beside Stan. It's the J.D. in me, baby.
He flipped up his collar and began to stalk around like James Dean in Rebel Without a Cause.
"They hurt me," he said, looking moody and scratching his chest. "You know, like, wow, my parents, school, society, everyone. It's pressure, baby. It's shit," Beverly said and sighed.
"I've got some firecrackers," Stan said, and they forgot all about glamours, Manitou's, and Richie's bad James Dean imitation as Stan produced a package of black cats from his hip pocket. Even Bill was impressed.
"Jesus Christ, Stustahan, well, where did you get the hose?"
"From this fat kid that I go to synagogue with sometimes," Stan said. "I traded a bunch of Superman and Little Lulu funny books for him."
"Let's shoot him off," Richie cried, nearly apoplectic in his joy. "Let's go shoot him off, Stanny. I won't tell any more guys you and your dad killed Christ. I promise. What do you say? I'll tell him your nose is small, Stanny. I'll tell him you're not circumcised."
At this, Beverly began to shriek with laughter and actually appeared to be approaching apoplexy before covering her face with her hands. Bill began to laugh, Eddie began to laugh, and after a moment, even Stan joined in. The sound of it drifted across the broad, shallow expanse of the Kandusky on that day before July 4th, a summer sound, as bright as the sun rays darting off the water, and none of them saw the orange eyes staring at them from a tangle of brambles and sterile blackberry bushes to their left. This brambly patch scrubbed the entire bank for 30 feet, and in the center of it was one of Ben's Morlock holes. It was from this raised concrete pipe that the eyes, each more than 2 feet across, stared. 5. The reason Mike ran afoul of Henry Bowers and his not-so-merry band on that same day was because the next day was the glorious 4th. The church school had a band in which Mike played the trombone. On the 4th, the band would march in the annual holiday parade playing the Battle Hymn of the Republic, Onward Christian Soldiers, and America the Beautiful. This was an occasion that Mike had been looking forward to for over a month. He walked to the final rehearsal because his bike had a busted chain. The rehearsal was not scheduled until 2:30, but he left at 1 because he wanted to polish his trombone, which was stored in the school's music room, until it glowed. Although his trombone playing was really not much better than Richie's voices, he was fond of the instrument, and whenever he felt blue, a half an hour of foghorning Sousa marches, hymns, or patriotic airs cheered him right up again. There was a can of Sadler's brass polish in one of the flap pockets of his khaki shirt, and 2 or 3 clean rags were dangling from the hip pocket of his jeans. The thought of Henry Bowers was the furthest thing from his mind. A glance behind as he approached Nebold Street and the church school would have changed his mind in a hurry, because Henry, Victor, Belch, Peter Gordon, and Moose Sadler were spread across the road behind him. If they had left the Bowers house 5 minutes later, Mike would have been out of sight over the crest of the next hill. The apocalyptic rock fight and everything that followed it might have happened differently, or not at all. But it was Mike himself, years later, who advanced the idea that perhaps none of them were entirely their own masters in the events of that summer. That if luck and free will had played parts, then their roles had been narrow ones. He would point out a number of these suspicious coincidences to the others at their reunion lunch, but there was at least one of which he was unaware. The meeting in the Barrens that day broke up when Stan Uris produced the black cats and the Losers Club headed toward the dump to shoot them off. And Victor, Belch, and the others had come out to the Bowers farm because Henry had firecrackers, cherry bombs, and M-80s. The possession of these last would a few years hence become a felony. The big boys were planning to go down beyond the train yard coal pit and explode Henry's treasures. None of them, not even Belch, went out to the Bowers farm under ordinary circumstances, primarily because of Henry's crazy father, but also because they always ended up helping Henry do his chores. The weeding, the endless rock picking, the lugging of wood, the toting of water, the pitching of hay, the picking of whatever happened to be ripe at that time of the season. Peas, cukes, tomatoes, potatoes. These boys were not exactly allergic to work, but they had plenty to do at their own places without sweating for Henry's kooky father, who didn't much care who he hit. He had once taken a length of stove wood to Victor Chris when the boy dropped a basket of tomatoes he was lugging out to the roadside stand. Getting whopped with a chunk of birch was bad enough. What made it worse was that Butch Bowers had chanted, "I'm gonna kill all the nips, I'm gonna kill all the fucking nips," when he did it. Dumb as he was, Belch Huggins had expressed it best. "I don't fuck with crazy people," he told Victor one day 2 years before. Victor had laughed and agreed. But the siren song of all those firecrackers had been too great to be withstood. "Tell you what, Henry," Victor said when Henry called him up that morning at 9 and invited him out.
I'll meet you at the coal pit around 1 o'clock. What do you say?
You show up at the coal pit around 1 and I'm not going to be there, Henry replied. I got too many chores. If you show up at the coal pit around 3, I will be there. And the first M-80 is going to go right up your old tan track, Vic.
Vic hesitated, then agreed to come over and help with the chores. The others came as well, and with the 5 of them, all big boys, working like fiends around the Bowers place, they got all the chores finished by early afternoon. When Henry asked his father if he could go, Bowers the elder simply waved a languid hand at his son. Butch was settled in for the afternoon on the back porch, a quart milk bottle filled with exquisitely hard cider by his rocker, his Philco portable radio on the porch rail. Later that afternoon, the Red Sox would be playing the Washington Senators, a prospect that would have given a man who was not crazy a bad case of cold chills. An unsheathed Japanese sword lay across Butch's lap, a war souvenir which, Butch said, he had taken off the body of a dying Nip on the island of Tarawa. He had actually traded 6 bottles of Budweiser and 3 joysticks for the sword in Honolulu. Lately, Butch almost always got out his sword when he drank. And since all of the boys, including Henry himself, were secretly convinced that sooner or later he would use it on someone, it was best to be far away when it made its appearance on Butch's lap. The boys had no more than stepped out into the road when Henry spied Mike Hanlon up ahead. "It's the nigger," he said, his eyes lighting up like the eyes of a small child contemplating Santa Claus's imminent arrival on Christmas Eve. "The nigger?" Belch Huggins looked puzzled. He had seen the Hanlons only rarely, and then his dim eyes lit up. "Oh, yeah, the nigger. Let's get him, Henry." Belch broke into a thunderous trot. The others were following suit when Henry grabbed Belch and hauled him back. Henry had more experience than the others chasing Mike Hanlon, and he knew that catching him was easier said than done. That black boy could move. "He don't see us. Let's just walk fast till he does. Cut the distance." They did so. An observer might have been amused. The 5 of them looked as if they were trying out for that peculiar Olympic walking competition. Moose Sadler's considerable belly joggled up and down inside his Derry High School t-shirt. Sweat rolled down Belch's face, which soon grew red. But the distance between them and Mike closed. 200 yards, 150 yards, 100. And so far, little Black Sambo hadn't looked back. They could hear him whistling. "What are you going to do to him, Henry?" Victor Criss asked in a low voice. He sounded merely interested, but in truth he was worried. Just lately, Henry had begun to worry him more and more. He wouldn't care if Henry wanted them to beat the Hanlon kid up, maybe even rip his t-shirt off or throw his pants and underwear up in a tree, but he was not sure that was all Henry had in mind. This year there had been several unpleasant encounters with the children from Derry Elementary Henry referred to as the Little Shits. Henry was used to dominating and terrorizing the Little Shits. But since March, he had been balked by them time and time again. Henry and his friends had chased one of them, the Four-Eyes Tozier kid, into freezes, and had lost him somehow just when it seemed his ass was surely theirs. Then, on the last day of school, the Hanscom kid. But Victor didn't like to think of that. What worried him, simply, was this. Henry might go too far. Just what too far might be was something Victor didn't like to think of. But his uneasy heart had prompted the question just the same. "We're going to catch him and take him down to that coal pit," Henry said. "I thought we'd put a couple of firecrackers in his shoes and see if he dances. But not the M-80s, Henry, right?" If Henry intended something like that, Victor was going to take a powder. An M-80 in each shoe would blow that nigger's feet off, and that was much too far. "I've got only 4 of those," Henry said, not taking his eyes off Mike Hanlon's back. They had closed the distance to 75 yards now, and he also spoke in a low voice. "You think I'd waste 2 of them on a fucking night fighter?" "No, Henry, course not." "We'll just put a couple of black cats in his loafers," Henry said. "Then strip him bare ass and throw his clothes down into the barrens. Maybe he'll catch poison ivy going after them." "We gotta roll him in the coal, too," Belch said, his formerly dim eyes now glowing brightly. "Okay, Henry, is that cool?" "Cool as a moose," Henry said in a casual way Victor didn't quite like. "We'll roll him in the coal, just like I rolled him in the mud that other time. And..." Henry grinned, showing teeth that were already beginning to rot at the age of 12. "And I got something to tell him. I don't think he heard when I told him before." "What's that, Henry?" Peter asked. Peter Gordon was merely interested and excited. He came from one of Derry's good families. He lived on West Broadway, and in 2 years he would be sent to prep school in Groton. Or so he believed on that July 3rd.
He was brighter than Vic Criss, but had not hung around long enough to understand how Henry was eroding.
"You'll find out," Henry said. "Now shut up. We're getting close."
They were 25 yards behind Mike, and Henry was just opening his mouth to give the order to charge when Moose Sadler set off the first firecracker of the day. Moose had eaten 3 plates of baked beans the night before, and the fart was almost as loud as a shotgun blast. Mike looked around. Henry saw his eyes widen.
"Get him!"
Henry howled. Mike froze for a moment, then he took off, running for his life. 6. The losers wound their way through the bamboo and the barrens in this order. Bill, Richie, Beverly behind Richie, walking slim and pretty in blue jeans and a white sleeveless blouse, Zori's on her feet. Then Ben, trying not to puff too loudly. Although it was 81 that day, he was wearing one of his baggy sweatshirts. Stan, Eddie bringing up the rear, the snout of his aspirator poking out of his right front pants pocket. Bill had fallen into a jungle safari fantasy, as he often did when walking through this part of the barrens. The bamboo was high and white, limiting visibility to the path they had made through here. The earth was black and squelchy, with sudden patches that had to be avoided or jumped over if you didn't want to get mud in your shoes. The puddles of standing water had oddly flat rainbow colors. The air had a reeky smell that was half the dump and half rotting vegetation. Bill halted one turn away from the Kanduskeg and turned back to Richie.
"Did the tiger up ahead, Tozier?"
Richie nodded and turned back to Beverly.
"Tiger," he breathed. "Tiger," she told Ben. "Man-eater?"
Ben asked, holding his breath to keep from panting.
"There's blood all over him," Beverly said.
"Man-eating tiger,"
Ben muttered to Stan, and he passed the news back to Eddie, whose thin face was hectic with excitement. They faded into the bamboo, leaving the path of black earth that looped through it magically bare. The tiger passed in front of them, and all of them nearly saw it. Heavy, perhaps 400 pounds, its muscles moving with grace and power beneath the silk of its striped pelt. They nearly saw its green eyes and the flecks of blood around its snout from the last batch of pygmy warriors it had eaten alive. The bamboo rattled faintly, a noise both musical and eerie, and then was still again. It might have been a breath of summer breeze, or it might have been the passage of an African tiger on its way toward the old Cape side of the barrens.
"Gone," Bill said.
He let out a pent-up breath and stepped out onto the path again. The others followed suit. Richie was the only one who had come armed. He produced a cap pistol with a friction-taped hand grip.
"I could have had a clear shot at him if you'd moved, Big Bill," he said grimly.
He pushed the bridge of his old glasses up on his nose with the muzzle of the gun.
"There's Wawawatusis around here," Bill said. "Can't risk a shot. You want them down onto the top of us?"
"Oh," Richie said, convinced. Bill made a come-on gesture with his arm, and they were back on the path again, which narrowed into a neck at the end of the bamboo patch. They stepped out onto the bank of the Kanduskeg, where a series of stepping stones led across the river. Ben had showed them how to place them. You got a big rock and plopped it in the water, then you got a second and plopped it in the water while you were stepping on the first, then you got a third and plopped it in the water while you were stepping on the second, and so on until you were all the way across the river, which here, and at this time of year, was less than a foot deep and shaled with tawny sandbars, with your feet still dry. The trick was so simple it was damn near babyish, but none of them had seen it until Ben pointed it out. He was good at stuff like that, but when he showed you, he never made you feel like a dummy. They went down the bank in single file and started across the dry backs of the rocks they had planted.
"Bill!"
Beverly cried urgently. He froze at once, not looking back, arms held out. The water chuckled and rilled around him.
"What?" "There's piranha fish in here. I saw them eat a whole cow 2 days ago. A minute after it fell in, there was nothing but bones. Don't fall off."
"Right," Bill said. "Be careful, men." They teetered their way across the rocks. A freight train charged by on the railway embankment as Eddie Kasprak neared the halfway point, and the sudden blast of its air horn caused him to jiggle on the edge of balance. He looked into the bright water, and for one moment, between the sun flashes that darted arrows of light into his eyes, he actually saw the cruising piranhas. They were not part of the make-believe that went with Bill's jungle safari fantasy. He was quite sure of that. The fish he saw looked like oversized goldfish with the great ugly jaws of catfish or groupers. Saw teeth protruded between their thick lips, and, like goldfish, they were orange. As orange as the fluffy pom-poms you sometimes saw in the suits the clowns wore at the circus.
They circled in the shallow water, gnashing. Eddie pinwheeled his arms.
I'm going in, he thought. I'm going in and they'll eat me alive.
Then Stanley Uris gripped his wrist firmly and brought him back to dead center.
Close call, Stan said. If you fell in, your mother'd give you heck.
Thoughts of his mother were, for once, the furthest things from Eddie's mind. The others had gained the far bank now and were counting cars on the freight. Eddie stared wildly into Stan's eyes, then looked into the water again. He saw a potato chip bag go dancing by, but that was all. He looked up at Stan again.
Stan, I saw.
What? Eddie shook his head.
Nothing, I guess, he said. I'm just a little...
But they were there, yes, they were there, and they would have eaten me alive.
Jumpy.
The tiger, I guess.
Keep going.
This western bank of the Kanduskeag, the old Cape Bank, was a quagmire of mud during rainy weather and the spring runoff, but there had been no heavy rain in Derry for 2 weeks or more, and the bank had dried to an alien crack glaze from which several of those cement cylinders poked, casting grim little shadows. About 20 yards farther down, a cement pipe jutted out over the Kanduskeag and spilled a steady, thin stream of foul-looking brown water into the river. Ben said quietly,
"It's creepy here,"
and the others nodded. Bill led them up the dry bank and back into the heavy shrubbery, where bugs whirred and chiggers chigged. Every now and then there would be a heavy ruffle of wings as a bird took off. Once a squirrel ran across their path, and about 5 minutes later, as they approached the low wrinkle of ridge that guarded the town dump's blind side, a large rat with a bit of cellophane caught in its whiskers trundled in front of Bill, passing along its own secret run through its own microcosmic wilderness. The smell of the dump was now clear and pungent. A black column of smoke rose in the sky. The ground, while still heavily overgrown except for their own narrow path, began to be strewn with litter. Bill had dubbed this dump dandruff, and Richie had been delighted. He had laughed almost until he cried.
"You ought to write that down, Big Bill," he said. "That's really good."
Papers caught on branches wavered and flapped like cut-rate pennants. Here was a silver gleam of summer sun reflected from a clutch of tin cans lying at the bottom of a green entangled hollow. There, the hotter reflection of sun rays bouncing off a broken beer bottle. Beverly spied a baby doll, its plastic skin so brightly pink it looked almost boiled. She picked it up, then dropped it with a little cry as she saw the whitish-gray beetle squirming from beneath its moldy skirt and down its rotting legs. She rubbed her fingers on her jeans. They climbed to the top of the ridge and looked down into the dump.
"Oh, shit," Bill said, and jammed his hands into his pockets as the others gathered around him.
They were burning the northern end today, but here, at their end, the dump keeper, he was, in fact, Armando Fazio, Mandy to his friends, and the bachelor brother of the Derry Elementary School janitor, was tinkering on the World War II D9 dozer he used to push the crap into piles for burning. His shirt was off, and the big portable radio sitting under the canvas parasol on the dozer's seat was putting out the Red Sox Senators' pre-game festivities.
"Can't go down there," Ben agreed.
Mandy Fazio was not a bad guy, but when he saw kids in the dump, he ran them off at once. Because of the rats, because of the poison he regularly sowed to keep the rat population down, because of the potential for cuts, falls, and burns, but mostly because he believed a dump was no place for children to be.
"Ain't you nice?" he would yell at the kids he spied, who had been drawn to the dump with their .22s to plink away at bottles,
or rats, or seagulls, or by the exotic fascination of dump picking. You might find a toy that still worked, a chair that could be mended for a clubhouse, or a junk TV with the picture tube still intact. If you threw a rock through one of these, there was a very satisfying explosion.
"Ain't you kids nice?" Mandy would bellow.
He bellowed not because he was angry, but because he was deaf and wore no hearing aid.
"Didn't your folks teach you to be nice? Nice boys and girls don't play in the dump. Go to the park, go to the library, go down to community house and play box hockey. Be nice."
"Nope," Richie said. "Guess the dump's out." They all sat down for a few moments to watch Mandy work on his dozer, hoping he would give up and go away, but not really believing he would. The presence of the radio suggested Mandy intended to stay all afternoon. It was enough to piss off the Pope, Bill thought. There was really no better place to come with firecrackers than the dump. You could put them under tin cans and then watch the cans fly into the air when the firecrackers went off. Or you could light the fuses and drop them into bottles and then run like hell. The bottles didn't always break, but usually they did.
"Wish we had some M-80s, Richie sighed, unaware of how soon one would be chucked at his head.
My mother says people ought to be happy with what they have, Eddie said so solemnly that they all laughed. When the laughter died away, they all looked toward Bill again. Bill thought about it and then said,
I know a place. There's an old gravel pit at the end of the barrens by the train yards.
Yeah, Stan said, getting to his feet. I know that place. You're a genius, Bill.
They'll really echo there, Beverly agreed.
Well, let's go, Richie said. The six of them, one shy of the magic number, walked along the brow of the hill which circled the dump. Mandy Fazio glanced up once and saw them silhouetted against the blue sky like Indians out on a raiding party. He thought about hollering at them. The Barrens was no place for kids. And then he turned back to his work instead. At least they weren't in his dump. 7. Mike Hamlin ran past the church school without pausing and pelted straight up Nebold Street toward the dairy train yards. There was a janitor at NCS, but Mr. Gendron was very old and even deafer than Mandy Fazio. Also, he liked to spend most of his summer days asleep in the basement by the summer silent boiler, stretched out in a battered old reclining chair with the dairy news in his lap. Mike would still be pounding on the door and shouting for the old man to let him in when Henry Bowers came up behind him and tore his freaking head off. So Mike just ran, but not blindly. He was trying to pace himself, trying to control his breathing, not yet going all out. Henry, Belch, and Moose Sadler presented no problems. Even relatively fresh, they ran like wounded buffalo. Victor Criss and Peter Gordon, however, were much faster. As Mike passed the house where Bill and Richie had seen the clown, or the werewolf, he snapped a glance back and was alarmed to see that Peter Gordon had almost closed the distance. Peter was grinning cheerfully, a steeplechase grin, a full-out polo grin, a pip-pip-jolly-good-show grin, and Mike thought, I wonder if he'd grin that way if he knew what's going to happen if they catch me. Does he think they're just going to say, tag, you're it, and run away? At the train yard gate with its sign, Private Property, Keep Out, Violators Will Be Prosecuted, loomed up. Mike was forced to let himself out to the limit. There was no pain, his breathing was rapid, yet still controlled, but he knew everything was going to start hurting if he had to keep this pace up for long. The gate was standing halfway open. He snapped a second look back and saw that he'd pulled away from Peter again. Victor was perhaps 10 paces behind Peter, the others now 40 or 50 yards back. Even in that quick glance, Mike could see the black anger on Henry's face. He skittered through the opening, whirled, and slammed the gate closed. He heard the click as it latched. A moment later, Peter Gordon slammed into the chain link, and a moment after that, Victor Criss ran up beside him. Peter's smile was gone. A sulky, balked look had replaced it. He grabbed for the latch, but of course there was none. The latch was on the inside. Incredibly, he said, Come on, kid, open the gate. That's not fair.
What's your idea of fair? Mike asked, panting. 5 against 1?
Fair up, Peter repeated, as if he had not heard Mike at all. Mike looked at Victor, saw the troubled look in Victor's eyes. He started to speak, but that was when the others pulled up to the gate.
Open up, nigger,
Henry bawled. He began to shake the chain link with such ferocity that Peter looked at him, startled.
Open up right now.
I won't, Mike said quietly.
Open up, Belch shouted. Open up, you fucking jigaboo.
Mike backed away from the gate, his heart beating heavily in his chest. He couldn't remember ever being quite this scared, quite this upset. They lined their side of the gate, shouting at him, calling him names for nigger he had never dreamed existed. Night Fighter, Ubangi, Spade, Blackberry, Jungle Bunny, others. He was barely aware that Henry was taking something from his pocket, that he had popped a wooden match alight with his thumbnail, and then a round red something came over the fence and he flinched instinctively away as the cherry bomb exploded to his left, kicking up dust. The bang silenced them all for a moment. Mike stared unbelievingly at them through the fence, and they stared back. Peter Gordon looked utterly shocked, and even Belch looked stunned.
They're scared of him now,
Mike thought suddenly, and a new voice spoke inside of him, perhaps for the first time, a voice that was disturbingly adult.
They're scared, but that won't stop them. You've got to get away, Mikey, or something's going to happen. Not all of them will want it to happen, maybe, not Victor and maybe not Peter Gordon, but it will happen anyway because Henry will make it happen. So get away fast.
He backed up another 2 or 3 steps, and then Henry Bowers said,
I was the one killed your dog, nigger.
Mike froze, feeling as if he had been hit in the belly with a bowling ball. He stared into Henry Bowers' eyes and understood that Henry was telling the simple truth. He had killed Mr. Chips.
That moment of understanding seemed nearly eternal to Mike. Looking into Henry's crazed, sweat-ringed eyes and his rage-blackened face, it seemed to him that he understood a great many things for the first time. And the fact that Henry was far crazier than Mike had ever dreamed was only the least of them. He realized above all that the world was not kind, and it was more this than the news itself that forced the cry from him.
You honky chicken shit bastard!
Henry uttered a shriek of rage and attacked the fence, monkeying his way toward the top with a brute strength that was terrifying. Mike paused a moment longer, wanting to see if that adult voice that had spoken inside had been a true voice. And yes, it had been true. After the slightest hesitation, the others spread out and also began to climb. Mike turned and ran again, sprinting across the train yards, his shadow trailing squat at his feet. The freight which the losers had seen crossing the barrens was long gone now, and there was no sound but Mike's own breathing in his ears and the musical jingle of chain link as Henry and the others climbed the fence. Mike ran across one triple set of tracks, his sneakers kicking back cinders as he ran across the space between. He stumbled crossing the second set of tracks and felt pain flare briefly in his ankle. He got up and ran on again. He heard a thud as Henry jumped down from the top of the fence behind him.
"Here I come for your ass, nigger," Henry bawled.
Mike's reasoning self had decided that the barrens were his only chance now. If he could get down there, he could hide in the tangles of underbrush in the bamboo. Or if things became really desperate, he could climb into one of the drain pipes and wait it out. He could do those things, maybe, but there was a hot spark of fury in his chest that had nothing to do with his reasoning self. He could understand Henry chasing after him when he got the chance, but Mr. Chips? Killing Mr. Chips?
My dog wasn't a nigger, you cheap shit bastard, Mike thought as he ran, and the bewildered anger grew.
Now he heard another voice, this one of his father's.
I don't want you to make a career out of running away. And what it all comes down to is that you have to be careful where you take your stand. You have to ask yourself if Henry Bowers is worth the trouble.
Mike had been running a straight line across the train yards toward the storage quonsets. Behind them, another chain-link fence divided the train yards from the barrens. He had been planning to scale that fence and jump over to the other side. Instead, he veered hard right toward the gravel pit. This gravel pit had been used as a coal pit until 1935 or so. It had been a stoking point for the trains which ran through the dairy yards. Then the diesels came, and the electrics. For a number of years after the coal was gone, much of the remainder stolen by people with coal-fired furnaces, a local contractor had dug gravel there, but he went bust in 1955, and since then the pit had been deserted. A spur railroad line still ran in a loop up to the pit and then back toward the switching yards, but the tracks were dull with rust, and ragweed grew up between the rotting ties. These same weeds grew in the pit itself, vying for space with goldenrod and nodding sunflowers. Amid the vegetation, there was still plenty of slag coal, the stuff people had once called clinkers. As Mike ran toward this place, he took his shirt off. He reached the rim of the pit and looked back. Henry was coming across the tracks, his buddies spread out around him. That was okay, maybe. Moving as quickly as he could, using his shirt for a bindle, Mike picked up half a dozen handfuls of hard clinkers. Then he ran back toward the fence, swinging his shirt by the arms. Instead of climbing the fence when he reached it, he turned so his back was against it. He dumped the coal out of his shirt, stooped, and picked up a couple of chunks. Henry didn't see the coal. He only saw that he had the nigger trapped against the fence. He sprinted toward him, yelling,
"This is for my dog, you bastard!"
Mike cried, unaware that he had begun to cry. He threw one of the chunks of coal overhand. It flew in a hard, direct line. It struck Henry's forehead with a loud bonk and then rebounded into the air. Henry stumbled to his knees. His hands went to his head. Blood seeped through his fingers at once, like a magician's surprise. The others skidded to a stop, their faces stamped with identical expressions of disbelief. Henry uttered a high scream of pain and got to his feet again, still holding his head. Mike threw another chunk of coal. Henry ducked. He began to walk toward Mike, and when Mike threw a third chunk of coal, Henry removed one hand from his gashed forehead and batted the chunk of coal almost casually aside. He was grinning.
"Oh, you're gonna get such a surprise," he said. "Such a... Oh, my God!"
Henry tried to say more, but only inarticulate, gargling noises emerged from his mouth. Mike had pegged another chunk of coal, and this one had struck Henry square in the throat. Henry buckled to his knees again. Peter Gordon gaped. Moose Sadler's brow was furrowed, as if he were trying to figure out a difficult math problem.
"What are you guys waiting for?"
Henry managed. Blood seeped between his fingers. His voice sounded rusty and foreign.
"Get him! Get the little cocksucker!"
Mike didn't wait to see if they would obey or not. He dropped his shirt and leaped at the fence. He began to pull himself up toward the top, and then he felt rough hands grab his foot. He looked down and saw Henry Bauer's contorted face, smeared by blood and coal. Mike yanked his foot up. His sneaker came off in Henry's hand. He pistoned his bare foot down into Henry's face and heard something crunch. Henry screamed again and staggered backward, now holding his spouting nose. Another hand, Belch Huggins's, snagged briefly in the cuff of Mike's jeans, but he was able to pull free. He threw one leg over the top of the fence, and then something struck him with blinding force on the side of his face. Warmth trickled down his cheek. Something else struck his hip, his forearm, his upper thigh. They were throwing his own ammunition at him. He hung briefly by his hands and then dropped, rolling over twice. The scrubby ground sloped downward here, and perhaps that saved Mike Hanlon's eyesight or even his life. Henry had approached the fence again and now looped one of his four M-80s over the top of the fence. It went off with a terrific crack that echoed and blew a wide bare patch in the grass. Mike, his ears ringing, went head over heels and staggered to his feet. He was now in high grass on the edge of the barrens. He wiped a hand down his right cheek and it came away bloody. The blood did not particularly worry him. He had not expected to come out of this unscathed. Henry tossed a cherry bomb, but Mike saw this one coming and moved away easily. "Let's get him," Henry roared and began to climb the fence. "Geez, Henry, I don't know." This had gone too far for Peter Gordon, who had never encountered a situation that had turned so suddenly savage. Things were not supposed to get bloody, at least not for your team, when the odds were comfortably slugged in your favor. "You better know," Henry said, looking back at Peter from halfway up the fence. He hung there like a bloated, poisonous spider in human shape. His baleful eyes stared at Peter. Blood rimmed them on either side. Mike's downward kick had broken his nose, although Henry would not be aware of the fact for some time yet. "You better know, or I'll come after you, you fucking jerk." The others began to climb the fence, Peter and Victor with some reluctance, Belch and Moose as vacantly eager as before. Mike waited to see no more. He turned and ran into the scrub. Henry bellowed after him, "I'll find you, nigger. I'll find you." 8. The losers had reached the far side of the gravel pit, which was little more than a huge, weedy pockmark in the earth now, 3 years after the last load of gravel had been taken out of it. They were all gathered around Stan, looking appreciatively at his package of black cats, when the first explosion came. Eddie jumped. He was still goofed up over the piranha fish he thought he had seen. He wasn't sure what real piranha fish looked like, but he was pretty sure they didn't look like oversized goldfish with teeth. "Marrow down easy, Eddie-san," Richie said, doing his Chinese coolie voice. "It's just other kids shooting off firecrackers." "That sissa sucks the river root, River Richie," Bill remarked. The others laughed. "I keep trying, Big Bill," Richie said. "I feel like if I get good enough someday, I'll earn your love." He made dainty kissing gestures at the air. Bill shot him the finger. Ben and Eddie stood side by side, grinning. "Oh, I'm so young and you're so old," Stan Uris piped up suddenly, doing an eerily accurate Paul Anka imitation. "This, my darling, I've been told."
"He can sing,"
Richie screeched in his pickaninny voice.
"Lawks mussy, this here boy can sing."
And then in the movie tone announcer's voice, "Want you to sign right here, boy, on this dotted line." Richie slung an arm around Stan's shoulders and favored him with a gigantic gleaming smile. "We're going to grow your hair out, boy. Going to give you a guitar. Going to..." Bill popped Richie twice on the arm, quickly and lightly. They were all excited at the prospect of shooting off firecrackers.
"Open them up, Stan," Beverly said. "I've got some matches."
They gathered around again as Stan carefully opened the package of firecrackers. There were exotic Chinese letters on the black label and a sober caution in English that got Richie giggling again. "Do not hold in hand after fuse is lit," this warning read.
"Good thing they told me," Richie said. "I always used to hold them after I lit them. I thought that's how you got rid of your frock and hangnails."
Working slowly, almost reverently, Stan removed the red cellophane and laid the block of cardboard tubes, blue and red and green, on the palm of his hand. Their fuses had been braided together in a Chinese pigtail.
"I'll unwind the..." Stan began,
and then there was a much louder explosion. The echo rolled slowly across the barrens. A cloud of gulls rose from the eastern side of the dump, squalling and crying. They all jumped this time. Stan dropped the firecrackers and had to pick them up.
"Was that dynamite?" Beverly asked nervously.
She was looking at Bill, whose head was up, his eyes wide. She thought he had never looked so handsome. But there was something too alert,
too strung up in the attitude of his head. He was like a deer scenting fire in the air.
That was an M-80, I think, Ben said quietly. Last 4th of July, I was in the park, and there were these high school kids that had a couple. They put one of them in a steel trash can. It made a noise like that.
Did it blow a hole in the can haystack? Richie asked.
No, but it bulged out the side. Looked like there was some little guy inside who just stroked it one. They ran away.
The big one was closer, Eddie said. He also glanced at Bill.
Do you guys want to shoot these off or not? Stan asked.
He had unbraided about a dozen of the firecrackers and had put the rest neatly back in the waxed paper for later.
Sure, Richie said.
Put them away. They looked at Bill questioningly, a little scared. It was his abrupt tone more than what he had said.
Put them away, Bill repeated, his face contorting with the effort he was making to get the words out. Spit flew from his lips. Something's gonna happen.
Eddie licked his lips. Richie shoved his glasses up the sweaty slope of his nose with his thumb, and Ben moved closer to Beverly without even thinking about it. Stan opened his mouth to say something, and then there was another smaller explosion, another cherry bomb.
Rocks, Bill said.
What, Bill? Stan asked.
Rocks! Ammo!
Bill began to pick up stones, stuffing them into his pockets until they bulged. The others stared at him as though he had gone crazy. And then Eddie felt sweat break out on his forehead. All of a sudden he knew what a malaria attack felt like. He had sensed something like this on the day he and Bill had met Ben. Except Eddie, like the others, was already coming to think of Ben as Haystack. The day Henry Bowers had casually bloodied his nose. But this felt worse. This felt like maybe it was going to be Hiroshima time in the Barrens. Ben started to get rocks, then Richie, moving quickly, not talking now. His glasses slipped all the way off and clicked to the gravelly surface of the ground. He folded them up absently and put them inside his shirt.
Why did you do that, Richie? Beverly asked. Her voice sounded thin, too taut.
Don't know, Keed, Richie said, and went on picking up rocks.
Beverly, maybe you better go back toward the dump for a while, Ben said. His hands were full of rocks.
Shit on that, she said. Shit all over that, Ben Hanscom. She bent and began to gather rocks herself. Stan looked at them thoughtfully as they grubbed for rocks like lunatic farmers. Then he began to gather them himself, his lips pressed into a thin and prissy line. Eddie felt the familiar tightening sensation as his throat began to close up to a pinhole.
Not this time, damn it, he thought suddenly. Not if my friends need me. Like Bev said, shit all over that.
He also began to gather rocks. 9. Henry Bowers had gotten too big too fast to be either quick or agile under ordinary circumstances, but these circumstances were not ordinary. He was in a frenzy of pain and rage, and these lent him an ephemeral, unthinking physical genius. Conscious thought was gone. His mind felt the way a late summer grass fire looks as dusk comes on, all rose red and smoke gray. He took after Mike Hanlon like a bull after a red flag. Mike was following a rudimentary path along the side of the big pit, a path which would eventually lead to the dump. But Henry was too far gone to bother with such niceties as paths. He slammed through the bushes and the brambles on a straight line, feeling neither the tiny cuts inflicted by the thorns nor the slaps of limber bushes striking his face, neck, and arms. The only thing that mattered was the nigger's kinky head, drawing closer. Henry had one of the M-80s in his right hand and a wooden match in his left. When he caught the nigger, he was going to strike the match, light the fuse, and stuff that ash can right down the front of his pants. Mike knew that Henry was gaining and the others were close on his heels. He tried to push himself faster. He was badly scared now, keeping panic at bay only by a grim effort of will. He had turned his ankle more seriously crossing the tracks than he had thought at first, and now he was limp skipping along. The crackle and crash of Henry's gopher-broke progress behind him called up unpleasant images of being chased by a killer dog or a rogue bear. The path opened out just ahead, and Mike more fell than ran into the gravel pit. He rolled to the bottom, got to his feet, and was halfway across before he realized that there were kids there, 6 of them. They were spread out in a straight line, and there was a funny look in their faces. It wasn't until later, when he'd had a chance to sort out his thoughts, that he realized what was so odd about that look. It was as if they had been expecting him.
Help! Mike managed as he limped toward them.
He spoke instinctively to the tall boy with the red hair.
Kids! Big kids!
That was when Henry burst into the gravel pit. He saw the 6 of them and came to a skidding halt.
For a moment, his face was marked with uncertainty, and he looked back over his shoulder. He saw his troops, and when Henry looked back at the losers, Mike was now standing beside and slightly behind Bill Denbro, panting rapidly. He was grinning.
"I know you, kid," he said, speaking to Bill.
He glanced at Richie.
"I know you, too. Where's your glasses, Four Eyes?"
And before Richie could reply, Henry saw Ben.
"Well, son of a bitch, the Jew and the fat boy are here, too. That your girlfriend, fat boy?"
Ben jumped a little, as if goosed. Just then, Peter Gordon pulled up beside Henry. Victor arrived and stood on Henry's other side. Belch and Moose Sadler arrived last. They flanked Peter and Victor, and now the two opposing groups stood facing each other in neat, almost formal lines. Panting heavily as he spoke, and still sounding more than a little like a human bull, Henry said,
"I got bones to pick with a lot of you, but I can let that go for today. I want that nigger, so you little shits buzz off."
"Right," Belch said smartly.
"He killed my dog,"
Mike cried out, his voice shrill and breaking.
"He said so."
"You come on over here right now," Henry said, "and maybe I won't kill you." Mike trembled but did not move.
Speaking softly and clearly, Bill said, "The Barbarians are ours. You cook a kids get out of here."
Henry's eyes widened. It was as if he'd been slapped unexpectedly.
"Who's gonna make me?"
he asked. "You, Horsefoot?"
Us, Bill said. "We're through taking your shit, Bowers. Get out."
"You stuttering freak," Henry said. He lowered his head and charged. Bill had a handful of rocks. All of them had a handful except Mike and Beverly, who was only holding one. Bill began to throw at Henry, not hurrying his throws, but chucking hard and with fair accuracy. The first rock missed. The second struck Henry on the shoulder. If the third had missed, Henry might have closed with Bill and wrestled him to the ground. But it didn't miss. It struck Henry's lowered head. Henry cried out in surprised pain, looked up, and was hit four more times. A little billet doux from Richie Tozier on the chest. One from Eddie that ricocheted off his shoulder blade, one from Stan Uris that struck his shin, and Beverly's one rock, which hit him in the belly. He looked at them unbelievingly, and suddenly the air was full of whizzing missiles. Henry fell back, that same bewildered, pained expression on his face.
"Come on, you guys," he shouted. "Help me."
"To charge them," Bill said in a low voice, and not waiting to see if they would or not, he ran forward. They came with him, firing rocks not only at Henry now, but at all the others. The big boys were grubbing on the ground for ammunition of their own, but before they could gather much, they had been peppered. Peter Gordon screamed as a rock thrown by Ben glanced off his cheekbone and drew blood. He backed up a few steps, paused, threw a hesitant rock or two back, and then fled. He had had enough. Things were not done this way on West Broadway. Henry grabbed up a handful of rocks in a savage, sweeping gesture. Most of them, fortunately for the losers, were pebbles. He threw one of the larger ones at Beverly, and it cut her arm. She cried out. Bellowing, Ben ran for Henry Bowers, who looked around in time to see him coming, but not in time to sidestep. Henry was off balance. Ben was 150, trying for 160. The result was no contest. Henry did not go sprawling, but flying. He landed on his back and skidded. Ben ran toward him again and was only vaguely aware of a warm, blooming pain in his ear as Belch Huggins nailed him with a rock roughly the size of a golf ball. Henry was getting groggily to his knees as Ben reached him and kicked him hard, his sneakered foot connecting solidly with Henry's left hip. Henry rolled over heavily on his back. His eyes blazed up at Ben.
"You ain't supposed to throw rocks at girls," Ben shouted.
He could not remember ever in his life feeling so outraged. "You ain't..." Then he saw a flame in Henry's hand as Henry popped the wooden match alight. He touched it to the thick fuse of the M80, which he then threw at Ben's face. Acting with no thought at all, Ben struck the ash can with the palm of his hand, swinging at it as one would swing a racket at a badminton birdie. The M80 went back down. Henry saw it coming. His eyes widened, and then he rolled away, screaming. The ash can exploded a split second later, blackening the back of Henry's shirt and tearing some of it away. A moment later, Ben was hit by Moose Sadler and driven to his knees. His teeth clicked together over his tongue, drawing blood. He blinked around, dazed. Moose was coming toward him, but before he could reach the place where Ben was kneeling, Bill came up behind him and began pelting the big kid with rocks. Moose wheeled around, bellowing.
"You hit me from behind, Yellow Belly," Moose screamed. "You fucking dirty fighter."
He gathered himself to charge, but Richie joined Bill and also began to fire rocks at Moose. Richie was unimpressed with Moose's rhetoric on the subject of what might or might not constitute yellow belly behavior. He had seen the five of them chasing one scared kid, and he didn't think that exactly put them up there with King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. One of Richie's missiles split the skin above Moose's left eyebrow. Moose howled. Eddie and Stan Urus moved up to join Bill and Richie. Beverly moved in with them, her arm bleeding but her eyes wildly alight. Rocks flew. Belch Huggins screamed as one of them clipped his crazy bone. He began to dance lumbersomely, rubbing his elbow. Henry got to his feet, the back of his shirt hanging in rags, the skin beneath almost miraculously unmarked. Before he could turn around, Ben Hanscom bounced a rock off the back of his head and drove him to his knees again. It was Victor Chris who did the most damage to the losers that day, partly because he was a pretty fair fastball pitcher, but mostly, paradoxically, because he was the least emotionally involved. More and more, he didn't want to be here. People could get seriously hurt in rock fights. A kid could get his skull split, a mouthful of broken teeth, could even lose an eye. But since he was in it, he was in it. He intended to dish out some trouble. That coolness had allowed him to take an extra 30 seconds and pick up a handful of good-sized rocks. He threw one at Eddie as the losers reformed their rough skirmish line, and it struck Eddie on the chin. He fell down, crying, the blood already starting to flow. Ben turned toward him, but Eddie was already getting up again, the blood gruesomely bright against his pallid skin, his eyes slitted. Victor threw at Richie, and the rock thudded off Richie's chest. Richie threw back, but Vic ducked it easily and threw one sidearm at Bill Denbro. Bill snapped his head back, but not quite quickly enough. The rock cut his cheek wide open. Bill turned toward Victor. Their eyes locked, and Victor saw something in the stuttering kid's gaze that scared the hell out of him. Absurdly, the words, "I take it back," trembled behind his lips. Except that was nothing you said to a little kid. Not if you didn't want your buddies to start ranking you to the dogs and back. Bill started to walk toward Victor now, and Victor began to walk toward Bill. At the same moment, as if by some telepathic signal, they began to throw rocks at each other, still closing the distance. The fighting flagged around them as the others turned to watch. Even Henry turned his head. Victor ducked and bobbed, but Bill made no such effort. Victor's rock slammed him in the chest, the shoulder, the stomach. One clipped by his ear. Apparently unshaken by any of this, Bill threw one rock after another, pegging them with murderous force. The third one struck Victor's knee with a brittle chipping sound, and Victor uttered a stifled groan. He was out of ammunition. Bill had one rock left. It was smooth and white, shot with quartz, roughly the size and shape of a duck's egg. To Victor Chris, it looked very hard. Bill was less than 5 feet away from him.
You could get out of here now, he said, or I'm going to split your head open. I'm a mean it.
Looking into his eyes, Victor saw that he really did. Without another word, he turned and headed back the way Peter Gordon had gone. Belch and Moose Sadler were looking around uncertainly. Blood trickled from the corner of the Sadler boy's mouth, and blood from a scalp wound was sheeting down the side of Belch's face. Henry's mouth worked, but no sound came out. Bill turned toward Henry.
Get out, he said. What if I won't?
Henry was trying to sound tough, but Bill could see a different thing in Henry's eyes. He was scared, and he would go. It should have made Bill feel good, triumphant even, but he only felt tired.
If you won't, Bill said, we're going to move in on you. I think the six of us can put you in the hospital.
Seven, Mike Hanlon said and joined them. He had a softball-sized rock in each hand.
Just try me, Bowers. I'd love to.
You fucking nigger!
Henry's voice broke and wavered on the edge of tears. That voice took the last of the fight out of Belch and Moose. They backed away, the remaining rocks dropping from relaxing hands. Belch looked around as if wondering exactly where he might be.
Get out of our place, Beverly said.
Shut up, you cunt,
Henry said. You... Four rocks flew at once, hitting Henry in four different places. He screamed and scrambled backward over the weed-rattled ground, the tatters of his shirt flapping around him. He looked from the grim, old young faces of the little kids to the frantic ones of Belch and Moose. There was no help there, no help at all. Moose turned away, embarrassed. Henry got to his feet, sobbing and snuffling through his broken nose.
I'll kill you all,
he said, and suddenly ran for the path. A moment later, he was gone.
Go on, Bill said, speaking to Belch. Get out! And don't come down here anymore. The barons are ours.
You're going to wish you didn't cross Henry, kid, Belch said. Come on, Moose.
They started away, heads down, not looking back. The seven of them stood in a loose semicircle, all of them bleeding somewhere. The apocalyptic rock fight had lasted less than 4 minutes, but Bill felt as if he had fought his way through all of World War II, both theaters, without so much as a single time out. The silence was broken by Eddie Kasprach's whooping, whining struggle for air. Ben went toward him, felt the three Twinkies and four ding-dongs he had eaten on his way down to the Barrens begin to struggle and churn in his stomach, and ran past Eddie and into the bushes, where he was sick as privately and quietly as he could be. It was Richie and Bev who went to Eddie. Beverly put an arm around the thin boy's waist while Richie dug his aspirator out of his pocket. "Bite on this, Eddie," he said, and Eddie took a hitching, gasping breath as Richie pulled the trigger.
"Thanks,"
Eddie managed at last. Ben came back out of the bushes, blushing, wiping a hand over his mouth. Beverly went over to him and took both of his hands in hers.
"Thanks for sticking up for me," she said.
Ben nodded, looking at his dirty sneakers.
"Any time, Keed," he said.
One by one, they turned to look at Mike, Mike with his dark skin. They looked at him carefully, cautiously, thoughtfully. Mike had felt such curiosity before. There had not been a time in his life when he had not felt it. And he looked back candidly enough. Bill looked from Mike to Richie. Richie met his eyes. And Bill seemed almost to hear the click, some final part fitting neatly into a machine of unknown intent. He felt ice chips scatter up his back. "We're all together now," he thought. And the idea was so strong, so right, that for a moment he thought he might have spoken it aloud. But of course there was no need to speak it aloud. He could see it in Richie's eyes, in Ben's, in Eddie's, in Beverly's, in Stan's. "We're all together now," he thought again. "Oh, God, help us. Now it really starts. Please, God, help us."
"What's your name, kid?" Beverly asked.
"Mike Hanlon."
"You want to shoot off some firecrackers?" Stan asked,
and Mike's grin was answer enough. Chapter 14. The Album. 1. As it turns out, Bill isn't the only one. They all bring booze. Bill has bourbon, Beverly has vodka and a carton of orange juice, Richie a six-pack, Ben Hanscom a bottle of Wild Turkey. Mike has a six-pack in the little refrigerator in the staff lounge. Eddie Kasprach comes in last, holding a small brown bag.
"What you got there, Eddie?" Richie asks. "Xyrex or Kool-Aid?"
Smiling nervously, Eddie removes first a bottle of gin and then a bottle of prune juice. In the thunderstruck silence which follows, Richie says quietly,
"Somebody call for the men in the white coats. Eddie Kasprach's finally gone over the top."
"Gin and prune juice happens to be very healthy," Eddie replies defensively. And then they're all laughing wildly, the sound of their mirth echoing and re-echoing in the silent library, rolling up and down the glassed-in hall between the adult library and the children's library.
"You go head on," Ben says, wiping his streaming eyes. "You go head on, Eddie. I bet it really moves the mail, too."
Smiling, Eddie fills a paper cup three-quarters full of prune juice and then soberly adds two capfuls of gin.
"Oh, Eddie, I do love you," Beverly says.
And Eddie looks up, startled but smiling. She gazes up and down the table.
"I love all of you."
Bill says,
"Well, we love you too, Bebev."
"Yes," Ben says, "we love you." His eyes widen a little, and he laughs.
"I think we still all love each other. Do you know how rare that must be?"
There's a moment of silence, and Mike is really not surprised to see that Richie is wearing his glasses.
"My contacts started to burn, and I had to take them out," Richie says briefly when Mike asks. "Maybe we should get down to business."
They all look at Bill then, as they had in the gravel pit, and Mike thinks,
"They look at Bill when they need a leader, at Eddie when they need a navigator. Get down to business. What a hell of a phrase that is. Do I tell them that the bodies of the children that were found back then and now weren't sexually molested, not even precisely mutilated, but partially eaten? Do I tell them I've got seven miners' helmets, the kind with strong electric lights set into the front, stored back at my house, one of them for a guy named Stan Uris, who couldn't make the scene, as we used to say? Or is it maybe enough just to tell them to go home and get a good night's sleep, because it ends tomorrow or tomorrow night for good, either for it or us?" None of those things have to be said, perhaps, and the reason why they don't has already been stated. They still love one another.
Things have changed over the last 27 years, but that, miraculously, hasn't. It is, Mike thinks, our only real hope. The only thing that really remains is to finish going through it, to complete the job of catching up, of stapling past to present, so that the strip of experience forms some half-assed kind of wheel. Yes, Mike thinks. That's it. Tonight the job is to make the wheel. Tomorrow we can see if it still turns, the way it did when we drove the big kids out of the gravel pit and out of the barrens. Have you remembered the rest? Mike asks Richie. Richie swallows some beer and shakes his head. I remember you telling us about the bird and about the smoke hole. A grin breaks over Richie's face. I remembered about that walking over here tonight with Bevy and Ben. What a fucking horror show that was. Beep, beep, Richie, Beverly says, smiling. Well, you know, he says, still smiling himself and punching his glasses up on his nose in a gesture that is eerily reminiscent of the old Richie. He winks at Mike. You and me, right, Mikey? Mike snorts laughter and nods.
Miss Scarlet, Miss Scarlet, Richie shrieks in his pickaninny voice. It's getting a little warm in the smokehouse, Miss Scarlet.
Laughing, Bill says, another engineering and architectural triumph by Ben Hanscom. Beverly nods.
We were digging out the clubhouse when you brought your father's photograph album to the Barrens, Mike.
Oh, Christ, Bill says, sitting suddenly bolt upright.
And the pictures.
Richie nods grimly. The same trick as in Georgie's room, only that time we all saw it. Ben says, I remembered what happened to the extra silver dollar. They all turn to look at him. I gave the other three to a friend of mine before I came out here, Ben says quietly, for his kids. I remembered there had been a fourth, but I couldn't remember what happened to it. Now I do. He looks at Bill. We made a silver slug out of it, didn't we? You, me, and Richie? At first we were going to make a silver bullet. You were pretty sure you could do it, Richie agrees. But in the end, we got cocoa for feet, Bill nods slowly. The memory has fallen naturally into its place, and he hears that same low but distinct click when it happens.
We're getting closer, he thinks.
We went back to Niebold Street, Richie says. All of us.
You saved my life, Big Bill, Ben says suddenly, and Bill shakes his head.
You did, though, Ben persists, and this time Bill doesn't shake his head. He suspects that maybe he had done just that, although he does not yet remember how. And was it him? He thinks maybe Beverly, but that is not there, not yet anyway.
Excuse me for a second, Mike says. I've got a six-pack in the back fridge.
Have one of mine, Richie says.
Hanlon no drinkum white man's beer, Mike replies. Especially not yours, trash mouth.
Beep, beep, Mikey, Richie says solemnly, and Mike goes to get his beer on a warm wave of their laughter. He snaps on the light in the lounge, a tacky little room with seedy chairs, a Silex badly in need of scrubbing, and a bulletin board covered with old notices, wage and hour information, and a few New Yorker cartoons now turning yellow and curling up at the edges. He opens the little refrigerator and feels the shock sink into him, bone deep and ice white. The way February cold sank into you when February was here and it seemed that April never would be. Blue and orange balloons drift out in a flood, dozens of them, a New Year's Eve bouquet of party balloons, and he thinks incoherently in the midst of his fear.
All we need is Guy Lombardo tootling away on Auld Lang Syne.
They waft past his face and rise toward the lounge ceiling. He's trying to scream, unable to scream, seeing what had been behind the balloons, what it had popped into the refrigerator beside his beer, as if for a late-night snack after his worthless friends have all told their worthless stories and gone back to their rented beds in this hometown that is no longer home. Mike takes a step backward, his hands going to his face, shutting the vision out. He stumbles over one of the chairs, almost falls, and takes his hands away. It is still there. Stan Uris's severed head beside Mike's six-pack of Bud Light. The head not of a man, but of an 11-year-old boy. The mouth is open in a soundless scream, but Mike can see neither teeth nor tongue because the mouth has been stuffed full of feathers. The feathers are a light brown and unspeakably huge. He knows well enough what bird those feathers came from. Oh, yes. Oh, yes, indeed.